In the Voice of Russia World Service, we present the program Red Line.
Welcome to the Voice of Russia and its weekend program, The Red Line. Every weekend, we, Sergei Strokan, Mira Salganik, and Yekaterina Kudashkina, invite you to discuss the most significant events of the week. We are joined by Russian and international experts, politicians, scientists and artists, sharing or opposing our views on the vast and increasingly interdependent world shared by all of us.
We want our program to be personal, provocative and fair.
So this week we will start with a big story on a small territory in Caucasus, Nagorno Karabakh. It has become an issue of dispute with two Caucasian states, Armenia and Azerbaijan, and also an area of one of the oldest and fiercest armed conflicts in the post-Soviet space. The issue of Nagorno-Karabakh resurfaced recently as President Medvedev, backed in his efforts by President Obama, hosted Armenia-Azerbaijani summit in Kazan, which ended with no results while both parties retorted to a new round of war of words. We shall then turn our eyes to Greece, which is struggling to avoid default, a scenario much feared in Europe. The Greek parliament finally approved a new austerity program aimed at reducing public spending. However, the policy could backfire. And finally, we're going to look at the latest twist in the career of one of the most controversial Ukrainian political figures, a former prime minister and currently the head of the opposition, Yulia Tymoshenko. She's facing up to 10 years in prison on charges of abuse of power. Ukrainian officials claim Ms. Tymoshenko is responsible for the country losing nearly $200 million in a contract she signed with the Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin back in 2009.
So, Katya, all in all, this time we have a program dominated by conflicts and crises both in our near and distant abroad. And as the summer goes to its second month, it is getting hotter in every sense.
Well, exactly, but I would like to add one thing more. All the three topics that we have chosen for this program, or the time has chosen for us, I don't know, have a very distinct European dimension, or should we say, European
Union
dimension.
Yes, I agree.
I didn't think about that, but maybe you have a point.
Yes, Europe certainly has a point, because they all have some bearing, some relation to the security and stability in Europe.
So, and the current situation of Europe.
Yes, Mira. So let's go straight to the subject. Beyond the headlines, this is our first section in which we will look at Nagorno-Karabakh, a tiny Caucasus mountain area squeezed between Armenia and Azerbaijan. It has become a place of one of the deadliest armed conflicts at a post-Soviet space. So this week, President Medvedev and President Obama put up additional pressure on Armenia and Azerbaijan to find a long-lasting solution to the conflict. However, things are turning not that easy. Armenian President Serge Sargsyan and Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev met in the Russian city of Kazan. So the meeting, which was hosted by President Dmitry Medvedev, brought no breakthrough on the two-decade-long territorial dispute over the Caucasian mountain region of Nagorno-Karabakh. So this revelation comes to the utter disappointment of both sides, as well as the world powers actively mediating the conflict under the umbrella of the OSCE Minsk Group, Russia, France and the US.
Well, this really turns out to be an uphill battle, Katya. I regret to say, but that flashes of optimism and high expectations on the eve of Kazan summit, they proved to be short-lived, and this is giving way to new pessimism. And maybe you've noticed this pessimism is dominating world media.
Well, have you noticed how quickly both parties to the conflict reverted to their customary, time-tested, you may say, practice of trading accusations, if not abuses, you know, rankling sabers, and so on and so forth?
So the war of words is always...
Well, it is not surprising at all. The only surprising thing is that they have just started it once they left Kazan. And just 2 days after the meeting, Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev, while making a keynote address at a military parade in Baku, declared that the country's military expenditures have been increased 20 times over the past 7 years, and at present exceeded the Armenian budget, can you imagine, by 50%. We have venerated our martyrs. They will be revenged. The military build-up will continue. This is what President Ilham Aliyev said.
Not surprisingly, Sergei.
I can imagine what his opposite number retorted.
Yes, well, the war of words, as we know. So he was rebuffed, of course, by his Armenian counterpart, Serge Sargsyan. And here is what Mr. Sargsyan said. We are for bilateral concessions, but must we make concessions with a state that is prepared to train weapons on us?
Well, you may ask, what about Russia, which is the third party of the three?
Yes, Sergei, tell us.
Let me refer to the recent publication in Kommersant Daily, which is quoting a highly placed, unnamed Kremlin source. And it revealed that after the Kazan summit, President Medvedev, while extremely disappointed, retained his determination to make it clear to both parties that he would agree to continue his mediating efforts only if both sides cede their present-day tactics of foot dragging and declare their willingness to sign a legally binding, I emphasize that, legally binding document, not just a statement, on a long-lasting solution in Nagorno-Karabakh enclave.
I think it's high time to make a brief historic introduction for the sake of those of our listeners.
Just to explain what is at stake, yes?
Well, you won't be surprised, but I think that many people won't be able to find Nagorno-Karabakh on the world map. So what have to do?
So go ahead, Mira.
Yes,
why
indeed.
Don't you do that?
Yes, indeed. Why do I trying to convince you it's necessary? The territorial dispute between the two neighboring Soviet republics, Armenia and Azerbaijan, broke out in 1988, full 3 years before the collapse of the Soviet Union. In the turbulent times that already began at that time of perestroika that were later labeled rather accurately as sovereignty's parade. Well, I must say that even before that, not much love was lost before between Muslim Shia Azerbaijan and Christian Armenia. And Armenia is particularly proud of the fact that she was one of the first states to make Christianity state religion. So it was there. And despite the Soviet propaganda that still went on with, you know, that fraternal family of all nations and things, the idea was already rather worn out. It was crumbling. So it started before.
Yeah, I think you have a point. Definitely it was crumbling. And by that time, the Nagorno-Karabakh Autonomous Republic, how it was called, which is predominantly populated by Armenians, was under the jurisdiction of the Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. But Nagorno-Karabakh announced its desire to secede from the control of Baku. And this is where conflict comes from. This is the initial point.
Quite right. Let me follow. The resulting war for Nagorno-Karabakh, which broke out in, as I said before, in 88, went on till 94. I mean, it's still going on.
It's simmering.
It's a source of constant tension, growing, decreasing a bit, but it's an ulcer which is festering, no doubt of it. So look, from 88 to 94, 30,000 lives were lost. And the whole thing has left Armenia and Azerbaijan in a prolonged state of a stalemate, not to mention that whatever Nagorno-Karabakh's claims for independence were, they are not
recognized. Well, yes, that's right.
They're not developing in any way.
Yes, Mira, because Nagorno-Karabakh was, in fact, added to the long list of the unrecognized states all over the world, you know, from the so-called Turkish Republic in northern Cyprus, the disputed Chinese island of Taiwan.
Pridnestrovye. Ex-Soviet territory.
Yes, and Polisario in the Western Sahara, yes, and the Basque country in Spain. So, you know, the list is endless.
Well, the list is really too long, but as we see, the talks on the future status of Nagorno-Karabakh, which started as early as 1994, which means 16 years back, and it was held under the framework of the so-called Minsk Group of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, so far haven't yielded any tangible results.
It looks like the, shall we say, the failure of the Kazan summit has only underscored the gravity, the sensitivity of the problem.
Well, it looks like some world leaders, namely President Medvedev, who was just initiating this Kazan summit, and President Obama and President Sarkozy, I engaged in something like a Sisyphean task of rolling a large stone to the top of the hill from which it will inevitably rock back down again.
Sergei, don't you sound quite pessimistic about it?
Well, Mira, not at all, and most experts give grim predictions for the future of the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict. While preparing for the program, I went to the world media, and world media is speaking about the failure of diplomacy and the shadow of a new hot war in the Caucasus.
But I'm not buying.
But I personally think there's more than one reason to believe that both sides, while trading accusations and building up their military might, still would not risk another war to resolve the issue.
Yes,
this is my personal point.
So could you expand a little bit on
this
that?
This is not a mainstream view here, but this is how I see
no,
it. Yeah, I can explain it, you know. First thing is the leadership in Baku and Yerevan obviously understand that if war breaks out, it would severely undercut, if not bury, their ambitions of integrating into another big family, the family of European nations.
True. So,
and this
look,
is a serious factor.
That's
you know?
A serious factor. And shortly before his trip to Kazan, President Aliyev paid a high-profile visit to Brussels. And it was the first visit in 2 years as the head of a massive delegation, which comprised key cabinet members along with the captains of Azeri industry, so to say. So, Mr. Aliyev was reported to have used this opportunity to meet key EU officials who are responsible for energy and the European neighborhood policy. And Azerbaijan has been a part of the ENP, the European neighborhood policy, since the year of 2007.
Yes,
and
indeed.
It's also been developing increasingly close ties with the EU as a cornerstone of this foreign policy. And by the way, don't forget, Sergei, but that this is a location where there are huge international interests, oil interests, gas interests invested into those facilities, which are located precisely in Azerbaijan. So I don't think really that the international business would allow a conflict. So I agree with you.
Katya, I think we will come to economic consideration, but just let me follow with what I've studied about political consideration.
Aren't they intertwined?
Do you know that Baku now is negotiating an association agreement with the European Union, which includes an easing of visa restrictions? And in practical terms, this will allow a great number of people to travel to the European Union and eventually lead to a visa-free travel regime. This is how things stand in Azerbaijan. And on his part, Armenian President Serge Sargsyan, during recent visit to the Council of Europe Parliamentary Assembly in Strasbourg, reaffirmed what he called a shared historical and cultural legacy with the European family of nations.
So, if integration into Europe is at stake, do you think that either side would jeopardize all their efforts just by testing each other?
And military strength.
And I don't know, I failed to find a word. Wouldn't it be really foolish to start a fresh armed conflict?
That's why my answer is no, and that's why I don't agree with those who say just that both sides are heading to another war.
I agree with you. I got your point,
Sergei. Well, if I may interfere for a second, I think that Katz is right, because, Sergei, you are being, if not pessimistic, too logical. There is a lot of emotional
emotions
feeling
are there.
Involved.
Yes.
Don't forget about the million refugees. I mean, there's always heavily around
anything can happen.
Any government's neck.
Yeah. The risk is there, but I agree with Sergei that in the long run, it would be extremely foolish to allow a conflict. And there are so many various interests invested there that perhaps they would somehow try to agree. And by the way, there's one more thing, Mira. Though the ethnic and religious contradictions are there, but also there are people who lived side by side for long years.
Look, they lived side by side for centuries.
Yes, so it is way more complicated than it might seem from outside.
Yes.
So let's hope that reason prevails.
Well, let us.
And to support the adherence of good reason, just let me give you some economic considerations. So Azerbaijan, with its vast gas reserves estimated to be at least 2.2 trillion cubic meters, is the key to the EU's southern energy corridor. And the country is already committed to supplying gas to the EU and being the gateway, so to say, to Central Asian gas. Azerbaijan also exhibits great potential as a transit state.
Absolutely so. The gas pensy is there.
That's right.
So this is another just proof that they would hardly train weapons on Armenia, as President Sargsyan says. I think that Aliyev would hardly try to scare off foreign investors and force the West to look for alternative supplies. This is obviously the last thing President Aliyev wants.
So I think there's one more point we've omitted. There's another anti-war argument which relates to security considerations, because Azerbaijan is seeking much closer cooperation with NATO.
And the case, that's a point, of course.
That's a point. And the case of the neighboring Georgia demonstrated all too clearly NATO's reservations against integrating a conflict-ridden country, a country with simmering conflict on its territory. So Armenia, for its part, is a member of the Collective Security Pact, which embraces 7 ex-Soviet republics with Russia as its informal leader. And now, 16 years after its creation, the body has worked out a comprehensive mechanism for preventing conflicts, including a collective rapid deployment force. So, a seemingly tiny Armenia is not alone, as the leadership in Baku surely knows, you know?
Well, Ed, some other reasons, which are, I mean, probably less tangible, but quite important. I mean, the international image of both of them, as well as their regional standing. Both of them are, I mean, they are neighbors. And Azerbaijan, Armenian diaspora, which is so strong, both in the United States and Europe, must be hanging heavily on Aliyev's mind if he's thinking of doing something rash about it. And Armenia, on its part, too, doesn't want another conflict with Azerbaijan, since she's so insistent on stressing her historical, traditional rapprochement to Turkey.
Oh, to Turkey, yeah.
Which is so frail as yet, because Turkey does not want yet, did not yet apologize for what the Armenians insist was genocide in 1916.
Right. So, all in all, if there is yet to appear a silver lining to the clouds in the Nagorno-Karabakh dispute, though the clouds look less ominous.
Well, at the moment, yes.
This is what I try to explain, and the pledge of global powers to end the conflict can't be written off.
So, the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict is definitely a heavy stone, but it has to be rolled to the top of the hill, to use your image, Sergei. Anyway.
It has to be rolled on the top of the hill with no feeling that it is a Sisyphean job in High Caucasus Mountain.
So it's high time to turn to our expert, and this time it's Sabine Fraser, director of the European program with the International Crisis Group.
Of course, the Kazan summit was a big disappointment. This is especially because the co-chairs before the summit had expressed a great deal of hope and optimism that there would be an agreement on the basic principles at this summit. The fact that the sides could not agree on the basic principles is very disappointing, but even the statement that they did sign is quite worrying, because what it says is that the two sides have agreed to certain issues, but what that makes assume is that there are other issues which they still fundamentally disagree on. So it's not about language in the text or about a temporary disagreement, but it's really still fundamental issues that separate Azerbaijan and Armenia. And I think that here we have to get back to the origins of the conflict, and where the two sides fundamentally disagree is on the status of Nagorno-Karabakh. For the Armenian side, they want to have an agreement where the right to self-determination and secession of Nagorno-Karabakh will be clear. And on the other hand, for the Azerbaijani side, they want to make sure that Nagorno-Karabakh will continue to remain inside the borders of Azerbaijan, or if it does get independence, this will be once the rest of Azerbaijan agrees to that. So fundamentally, there's a very clear disconnect between the sides, and the co-chairs have been trying to deal with that by saying, let's have an interim status and a postponement of any kind of vote on Nagorno-Karabakh status. But on one hand, that would be a very good solution, and that would be a solution that I believe the co-chairs should continue to promote. But what we see is that neither Azerbaijan nor Armenia are willing to go for that. And what's clear in the run-up to Kazan is that they had not been trying to inform their people and to convince their people that the solution was necessary. And this is what I think is also very worrying, is that we still see very radical rhetoric coming, particularly from Baku, but also in Armenia. In Armenia, what we see is that people are less and less willing to consider full withdrawal from the occupied territories of Nagorno-Karabakh. So that is also a very worrying trend. So it is clear that if there is going to be an agreement on Nagorno-Karabakh, the presidency, both in Azerbaijan and in Armenia, has to be much clearer in public, in Baku and in Yerevan, explaining to the people that this agreement is necessary to avoid a future war.
But Sabine, please tell me, what do you think is the major problem, why they come to terms? Because this is an area where people lived side by side, Armenians and Azerbaijanis, they lived together, and actually it was not that explosive as it is now. So what is it, why that happened?
I mean, of course, Azerbaijanis and Armenians have lived side by side for centuries, but we have a situation of 20 years of separation where there are, of course, a large number of IDPs. There is territory that is occupied. But in addition to that, there's been a very negative rhetoric where people have been brought up now basically hating the other. And it's going to take years for people to change that and to again feel trust and confidence with each other. That is why it is clear that unless the presidents make it very clear to their population that something has changed and that it is necessary to reach an agreement now, it is going to be very difficult for there to be public support for any compromise.
Now, as I've spoken to a number of analysts, they were telling me that there are some fears that the whole situation might explode again. Well, I have my doubt. How do you see that?
I am also concerned that there is a possibility that a war will start again. If this negotiation process fails, that will put us in a very precarious situation. I believe that Russian President Medvedev has played a very important role over the past couple of years, and it's now questionable whether or not in an election period he will be able to continue playing such a hands-on role. But it's also a problem with the French and the Americans, who are also going to have elections soon. So if we don't get an agreement in the coming couple of months, it's clear that the negotiations are going to go onto the back burner. Without an active negotiations process, it's going to encourage both sides to think more about military conflict. Of course, both countries are spending more and more money on purchasing military equipment. And when you start buying a lot of kit, the kind of natural tendency is to have a desire to use it. So what I'd be worried about is that even if neither Baku nor Yerevan are planning an offensive tomorrow, that a war might start by accident. Because of this increased belligerent rhetoric, the increased weaponry that's on the ground, and this kind of natural tendency to want to try it out.
Sabine, wouldn't it be absolutely crazy? I mean, with Azerbaijan looking at expanding its ties with NATO, and NATO, as far as I know, has got serious reservations about nations with inner conflict. And on the one hand, then both nations are looking at expanding their ties with the European Union. And once the war starts, all their hopes would be dashed.
Correct. But I mean, that what I think is neither Azerbaijan nor Armenia are too keen to join NATO right now. Of course, they are keen in increasing their ties with NATO, but actual NATO membership is very far down the line. Same thing with the EU process. None of the countries of the South Caucasus have a clear EU membership commitment. So it's very difficult for either NATO or the European Union to really put pressure on Azerbaijan and Armenia to resist a war, because they don't have anything to offer. There's no clear carrot of either NATO or EU membership for these two countries.
How about economic considerations? Because as far as I understand, Baku is home to considerable oil and gas interests.
Yes, it is true that if Azerbaijan went to war, this would undermine their capacity to export oil and gas. On one hand, it's possible that the reserves of Azerbaijan will start to diminish, and they will have less of a qualms to go to war because they will have less oil and gas to export. But also, I think the problem in Azerbaijan is that they feel that this could be a quick war and that they could take back one or three of the occupied territories in a few days, and that this would thus not have a direct effect on their pipelines. This, I think, is a wrong calculus because the Armenians are also prepared to retaliate. So if a war starts, I don't think it will be a short war, but it will be something that will last numerous months and perhaps years, which would have an impact on Azerbaijan's ability to export its reserves.
But did you travel there?
Yes, I have been to Karabakh. I have not been for some time, I have to admit. It was a few years ago that I went, but I did go there. So, I mean, I have seen the realities on the ground. And, of course, one additional element that we don't talk about enough is the people of Karabakh itself, both the Karabakh Azeris and Karabakh Armenians. It is clear that if there was an agreement on basic principles, it would be necessary to include them more in how to actually implement this agreement and how to reach an actual comprehensive peace agreement. You know, the process is that first there would be the basic principles, and after that the sides would have to sit down and talk about the details and sign a comprehensive peace agreement. For that, you would need input from the Karabatis themselves, both Armenian and Azeris, because obviously in the implementation, they will play a key role. So, yes, they need
what
to
What is
be
their sentiment?
I think their sentiment, especially the Karabakh Armenians, is even more hardline than the sentiment in Yerevan, because they feel the security threats more clearly. So that is why for any peace agreement to work, it would have to have very clear security guarantees. There would need to be deployment of international peacekeepers. So that way, the people living in Karabakh could feel more confident with the situation. That is also why the interim status is so important, because again, here, the people of Karabakh would be able to feel that they have a status, not a full-fledged independent status, but they have something that would allow them, for example, to be represented abroad and to be able to talk with countries outside the region.
Sabine, thank you very much.
You're tuned to the Voice of Russia.
And now I suggest we might move to our next section, Between the Lines, in which we usually look at the most notable and provocative stories of the week. And this time I suggest we might discuss the Guardian editorial published last Wednesday. The piece focuses on the recent developments in Greece and is entitled Greece and Austerity, Brussels versus the People.
Wow. Doesn't it sound a bit too leftist for a paper like The Guardian? What happens?
Well, I'm not sure it sounds leftist, but now as you say that, I know that my choice was right. The story's definitely provocative.
Well, let's hope, Katya, it's also fair, like we in our program like to say.
You'll tell me about it after we've looked at it. So, here we go. Just let me quote. For anyone who has ever worried about the democratic deficit in Europe, the editorial begins, here it was, laid bare. Under orders from Brussels and Washington, MPs in Athens passed a slew of stringent measures to raise 28 billion euros in a hurry, even while hundreds of thousands of protesting Greeks faced massive amounts of tear gas and riot police.
Oh yes, I have seen the riots in the news. People gathered in front of the parliament, and remember that story about the finance minister? They look really desperate.
Really desperate, I agree. Oh,
but they were also quite active, and protesters were said to have been throwing pieces of marble at the police, and the police used tear gas to dispel the crowd.
Well, you know, Sergei, the parliament approved the package despite all the protests.
Unprecedented process.
Unprecedented, but okay, called the decision unprecedented too, but it has been made.
Yes, precisely, Mira. That's the point the Guardian story is making. And just let me quote it again. In fact, it says, those protesters were not a vocal minority. Polls suggest that up to 80% of Greeks reject these austerity measures. 80% of Greeks, mind you, that's the electorate, that's the core electorate.
This is the country.
This is the country.
Tell you what, ladies, all this reminds me of the Arab Spring Revolution.
Oh, come on, Sergei. Isn't it a little bit too far-fetched?
Just let me explain. If you remember, in each of the countries affected, it started with power showing total disregard for the grievances of its own people. And their protests, however passionate and justified they were ignored. You know about that. And then it burst.
Sergei, but this time the situation is still different. I'd say
Papandreou is not a dictator.
Papandreou is not a dictator, though he's one of the family that has been in power for ages.
So what?
By the way.
But
yes.
That's
he's
a
not
a
dictator,
story.
Yes. So I'd say that Greece has been caught between Scylla and Charybdis, you know. In one of his recent statements, the EU Economic Affairs Chief, Olli Rehn, made it plain and clear that if the radical measures were not ratified by Athens Parliament, Greece would not receive the next tranche. And mind you, the country needs money real bad. We're talking about 12 billion euros to pay wages and pensions in the coming month. So if it doesn't get the money, it automatically defaults on its debt, which amounts to 355 billion euros. Isn't it a shake-up for the whole of the eurozone?
Well, of course it is, no doubt of that, but there is something to look at more, to look into more carefully. Because, I mean, talking about things like this, one shouldn't rush to conclusions.
Well, I've just thought that we have too much of antique mythology today, Sisyphus and now Scylla and Charybdis. Well, but jokes aside...
But this is Greece.
Oh, yeah, but jokes aside. Amira, you might remember that Greece adopted the first package of austerity measures roughly a year ago. And it hasn't worked. It hasn't worked.
Well, the question is why? Are you saying the measures are bad or that it has more up to corruption and lack of transparency or lack of efficiency, perhaps one doesn't know, and mismanagement and bureaucracy? So, there ought to be a reason why
Mira,
it didn't work.
Mira, look, if we talk of all that, do you know that some analysts say Russia might face a similar scenario?
Oh, come on.
Well, not yet. And what do you mean by it, Sergei?
It's not mine. It's Sergei Ulatov, another Sergei, the resident World Bank economist in Moscow. Here is what he says. By 2030, the debt level would be unsustainable like in Greece. Right now, we are mostly helped by oil prices and not by a very prudent macroeconomic policy. This is his view.
Could that be the reason why the Russian finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, urged the government to cap annual spending increases at 4%, and now there's more discussion about introducing new taxes, etc., etc. Could that be the reason?
Well, there ought to be some reason for what Kudrin said, because he's not sort of a careless man. And he's the financial boss, so he ought to be different. But Ulatov expressed his vision. It was not the official position of the World Bank, right?
Well?
And the WB, as far as I know, says that Russia, which is one of the world's largest energy exporters, is going to have monetary and current account surpluses this year and the next year. The World Bank says that Russia faces no traditional fiscal sustainability issues, but the WB prediction, as far as I can see, is for a couple of years.
Well, a couple of years,
and
again,
oil
it is
prices,
based on oil prices.
And the oil prices are slackening the recovery.
I'm sorry, just let me remind you. Now we're talking not of the economics, but of democracy. And the Guardian story is all about Greece and democracy,
right,
or lack of it, rather.
Moreover, you know, we're not talking about the perspectives of Russia. Right now, we're discussing Greece.
And Europe.
And Europe, of course. And isn't transparency a part of democracy?
Yes, true, Mira. But, however, the editorial looks into just how democratic the process of decision-making on those painful issues is. And their point is that to save the whole of the Eurozone from another financial crisis, Greece, or rather Greek government, was made to act against the will of its own people, which is not exactly a democratic procedure, by the way. And just let me quote the paper. What the socialist government has just accepted is just as brutal and radical as any structural adjustment policy imposed by the International Monetary Fund. Only it has been forced on Greece by its supposed friends and neighbors in the Eurozone.
Brutal, radical, what a language they use.
You know, Mira, those measures really are radical, to say the least. Just let me give some key figures. So, a big increase in income taxes and national insurance contributions. 150,000 public sector jobs to be cut. And those keeping their jobs are facing a salary cut by 15%.
Well, I'd say this is the price the country has to pay for the excesses
of its
elite.
But isn't it too high? Isn't it too high?
Well, look, I cannot count it. Neither can you. The point is that Greece is in debt, right? It has to pay it up, or this is a blow on the Eurozone. So we're not discussing the prices.
Well, first of all, I think there are ways, and I also think that we all know that certain medicine still affects the health.
Well, but there's another implication I want to talk about. Some say that spending cuts, privatization and tax increases could wipe out the country's middle class.
Oh, my.
And
yes,
we all know just how important it is for a nation's successful economic development everywhere, all over the world, be it Greece
and
or,
you know,
India,
Sergei,
or Russia,
right,
or
the
United States.
So, and now it reminds me of the Arab Spring. Countries like Libya or Yemen, where the change goes especially painfully, have almost no middle class. Their societies have been strongly polarized, which only made them weaker in the face of more economic blows.
And this is a very important point that Katya is making. Very important.
Katya, in that sense, I think really you're right about those Arab countries. But please note that Greece might be different. It is a part of the European Union, remember?
Well, we'll still have to see, Sergei. And before we turn to our guest speaker for his expert opinion, I'd like to quote the Guardian editorial again for the last time. Greece, it says, is being pumped with cash so it can repay its debts to German and French banks. The financiers are being bailed out while the economy craters, society's pushed to breaking point, and Greek politics becomes even more combustible. And now let's listen to Dr. John Nomikos, director of the Athens-based Research Institute for European and American Studies.
Well, the point is, we had a very critical vote on the Greek parliament. Of course, you know, the government passed, you know, the bill by 155 vote. But the point is, even the success of the Greek government, we have a critical problem in Greece, like, you know, the socio-skeleton of the Greek society is falling apart. Number one. Number two, you know, we have an increase of unemployment, and many people right now are losing their jobs. And number three, we have a big security problem here, not only, you know, on the Greek and Turkish border, but the illegal immigration problem is getting worse. Don't forget that we have, you know, almost 1 million illegal immigrants who are already unemployed, because they are illegal, of course. And this number, you know, is added by the Greek unemployed that increases day by day. Now, on one side, we have the success of the Greek government, and the other side, we have, you know, the breakup of the Greek society. And in the short term, the government is winning, but in the long term, the society is going to have, you know, a lot of Brablum. We have already Brablum, but the society, you know, is going to react on more demonstrations, and the social problems, you know, are going to increase instead of decrease. Even though the Greek government is telling today, even one day after the vote, that we are going to have a growth, but until we see the growth, what is going to be in the middle of the problem? The Greeks are very upset, they are very, you know, desperate, they want to see some results today after, you know, 1.5 year austerity measure.
So, do I get you right that the austerity measures have been in place for 1.5 years and they did not work?
Well, not exactly what they promised to us, because instead of seeing, you know, some light in the tunnel, we see more frustration, and we see more people lose their job. We see more medium-sized companies, you know, shut off. We see, you know, the increase of unemployment. We see increase of crime. In other words, there is no counterbalance between austerity measures and some light in the tunnel regarding economic development.
But what could be done about the situation?
Well, the point is that the people should realize that the problem in Greece is not only, you know, reforming the public administration or the Greek in general. The problem is systemic, and the problem is how you can get the right people on the right jobs, evaluate these people depending on their CVs, and of course, the biggest problem we face here is corruption. And corruption is political corruption, is corruption in the civil servant, you know, in the public administration. So we need, be careful of the words that I'm going to say, independent justice. We need the independent judges that are not connected to the political system or the government official. They are there to do exactly what the word said, justice and combat corruption in all law, in the whole entire society, so people, Greek people, can trust you, and they see that exactly you get some people in the jail. Because here, I mean, you fight a lot of corruption, but you're not really doing a lot of things. So people are frustrated because they see what sacrifices they are asking to do. In the long term, they see no light. I'm telling you exactly the fact because I'm a researcher.
Yes, I know, Dr. Nomikos. So do I get you right that with the current austerity measures being voted on and adopted, still no more light is in sight?
Well, let's see. Let's be a little bit optimist. Until now, we have to go through to this austerity measure, right? This, but the point is the government has no time. They have to do the reforms faster. And now, be careful, you know, in the Mediterranean countries, when we have summertime, things are going slow. And the people who are supposed to start working now, I'm afraid they might go on holiday, and the summertime is not the best environment to proceed reform faster. So July and August might be a little bit slow, and then September and October people will come back to their work. Situation is going to be like a social volcano, and I'm afraid, without having some kind of inside information, that we are going to have more social problem in September, October, if something has not happened yet. And we might find ourselves in a surprise like an election, but under, you know, tremendous pressures from the international environment.
Right. Dr. Nomikos, thank you very much.
This is the Voice of Russia.
And now we shall be moving to Red Line's concluding section with a new title, A Face in the News. The face in the news we are going to discuss this week must be familiar to many of our listeners, Yulia Tymoshenko, with her trademark peasant-style braid, a charismatic Ukrainian political figure who is constantly included in the world lists of the most influential women of the world. This is a face that certainly stays in memory. Ms. Tymoshenko, known in Ukraine as the Gas Princess, twice Prime Minister of Ukraine, now in opposition, faces a term of up to 10 years being accused of abuse of power. The charges are connected to a contract she signed with Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin after a gas dispute with Russia in early 2009. Ukrainian officials claim Ms. Tymoshenko caused the country to lose nearly $200 million when she signed the contract.
Well, Katya, opposition insists that Yulia Tymoshenko has become a subject of sort of political vendetta on the part of her longtime arch foe, Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych. And there's a belief that he wants simply to put her to jail to sideline her from big politics well before parliamentary and presidential elections in the country.
Well, in a situation like this, Ukrainian opposition usually turns its eyes to the West, seeking support. However, this time, things are not that simple. Though Western governments have not come down publicly on Tymoshenko's side, visiting EU politicians have told the current Ukraine leadership they're concerned over the possible use of selective justice in Ukraine.
Oh.
Katya, I think that's this is maximum support Yulia Tymoshenko can enjoy at this time.
Oh, really? She was so popular with the European politicians.
But this is not the case anymore, and it seems that the overwhelming enthusiasm which was shown by the West at the time of the Ukrainian so-called Orange Revolution of 2004, in which Yulia Tymoshenko was obviously one of the architects and key leaders, has almost evaporated. It faded away. The Velvet Revolution in Kyiv, with its rosy expectations of Ukraine quickly joining big European family home, was mishandled. Grossly mishandled. And now Yulia Tymoshenko and her standoff with another victor, former President Viktor Yushchenko, are largely to be blamed for the failure of the Ukrainian democratic reforms. This is how things stand now. Sorry
and
to say that.
You know, the whole scenario gives one an overwhelming sense of déjà vu.
Oh yes, Mira. Déjà vu in many ways.
Indeed.
It is a universal scenario, really. A dethroned leader is accused of something which nobody used to oppose while the said leader wasn't in the office. And the list of charges is standard. Look, the abuse of power, embezzlement of state funds, corruption. So the leader denies everything. He declares the accusations are false and politically motivated. And Western human rights campaigners express their concern, but this can hardly change anything. So it's all on the same over and over again. Mm-hmm. We've seen that dozens of times, all over
in
the world.
In dozens of countries.
All over the world, sure.
Indeed. Okay, but don't you think that anyway we must tell our listeners more about the Ukrainian version of this universal scenario?
So how it deepens?
Yes. Coming back to Ukrainian Spring, which, by the way, came well ahead of today's recent Arab Springs.
Oh, Arab Spring again? Well, really, let's go to the Ukrainian
let's
version.
Let's get to forget the Arabs for a while, if you can.
So, Yulia Tymoshenko, with her trademark braid, first hit the world headlines and became an international figure back in 2004 as a leader of the Orange Revolution, or rather an able administrator of mass protests that brought hundreds of thousands to the streets, prompting Viktor Yanukovych to accept his defeat in the 2004 presidential election.
And the street demonstrations effectively ended Mr. Yanukovych's first bid for his presidency.
So, let's come back to the current charges against Yulia Tymoshenko over a gas contract with Russia.
Well, I think the keywords in the whole thing are the gas, Russia, and of course, déjà vu.
Well, in fact, Ms. Tymoshenko has been known in Ukraine as gas princess since the late 1990s, as the owner of a company that traded in Russian gas. By that time, already there were nasty rumors of stolen gas and avoided taxes, but she soon became the gas princess and the richest woman in the whole of the 50 million people Ukrainian nation.
And after the Orange Revolution?
Yes, she became the first woman to be elected prime minister of Ukraine. So that's simple. That's a rather simple story.
And in February 2010, many people were disillusioned, really, with the Orange Revolution leaders, and they realized that Yushchenko and Tymoshenko had failed to deliver on their promises. So Yulia Tymoshenko lost to Yanukovych in a bitter fight for the presidency. And look, what strikes me now is a certain similarity of all victorious street actions. Orange Revolution or Jasmine Revolution or any other revolution.
So, they seem to be always following a standard pattern, like we said. Any flower revolution eventually results in a massive popular disillusionment, and that plays an important role in further political developments. So, take Yulia Tymoshenko. She's still remaining popular across the country, but neither could she raise another mass protest action. One knows that opportunity is never twice, nor unify the opposition. So she is no longer a valid political figure.
Yet President Yanukovych remembers that Tymoshenko narrowly lost to him in the last year's presidential election.
Okay.
He knows her to be a really ferocious enemy with a well-deserved reputation of a political fury a firebrand, the type that never takes no for an answer. So I think that Sergei is quite right. Yanukovych will do his best, whatever he can, to put her behind the bars or find any other way to keep her away from big politics.
Okay, then. But still, let's look at the charges which have been put against her. The charges that carry a maximum sentence of 10 years in prison,
That's
by the
quite
way.
A lot.
Yes. The prosecution alleges that Tymoshenko, without consulting her government, forced the then-head of state energy firm Naftogaz to sign the gas deal with Russia's Gazprom. So, Ms. Tymoshenko says the case against her is part of a wider political plot. And here's just what she says. The aim of this trial is the liquidation of a working opposition in Ukraine.
And the gas supply agreement ended a standoff between Moscow and Kyiv, as you remember. The core issue, divisive issue, was the pricing of Russian gas. And eventually, when the conflict broke out, as you remember, it had led to supplies being cut off to Western Europe. So, although it has since been denounced by Yanukovych leadership
as a sellout,
Kyiv is continuing to observe it.
And meanwhile, the Western Europe is continuing to look for more reliable ways of getting
gas,
energy.
Would you agree, Sergei, that this dramatic clash between Tymoshenko and Yanukovych that attracts such public attention, both in Ukraine and worldwide, looks more like a fight for the room at the top than a real struggle of two political parties with different political agendas? Well, though I understand they too are struggling for room at the top.
You do have a point, Katya. And though there is a lot of difference in programs of Yanukovych's Party of Regions and Tymoshenko's Batyushchina, which is Ukrainian fatherland, it is not what the two are fighting over. The way I see it, the current political situation in Ukraine looks like the Brownian movement we all remember from our physics textbooks. Much depends on chance and momentary political expediency. And strangest, I would say, political alliances are formed and broken up in what looks as a chaotic game without any rules.
Still, Sergei, I think there must be some kind of a dominating factor involved in this chaos.
I'd say the trump card in Ukrainian political game is Russia. A politician in Ukraine has primarily to take a stand vis-a-vis Russia. This will be his declaration of intent on which a politician is to be judged by the electorate.
And Ukrainian leaders used to make dramatic turnarounds in their stance on the relations with Russia, depending on what electoral group's support is a priority at the moment.
Symbolically, this was the case with all major political players in the last years. For instance, Yulia Tymoshenko, who at one time viewed Moscow as a threat and was largely seen as anti-Russian, ended with signing a gas deal with Putin. And Yanukovych, who initially was considered pro-Russian due to his sugary promises of building eternal friendship with Moscow, now is accusing Tymoshenko of trading national interests to Russia.
So Yanukovych, who only last year needed the voices of Russia-friendly electorate while being an incumbent, as a president now is begging for friendly prices for gas and is secretly negotiating expanding cooperation with NATO, which he lambasted during his presidential campaign. And he has given green light to the notorious sea breeze maneuver in the Black Sea, which irritated Moscow so much. So what kind of signals he's giving?
I think by trying to sue Tymoshenko for what is believed gas treason, Yanukovych is showing that he is not a puppet of Moscow. But what has it to do with the priority of law and order? I think this is not really a politics of high standards. And what stands to lose definitely is Russian-Ukrainian relations.
Well, I guess we ought to ask our experts to further elaborate on this important factor in Ukraine's political makeup. And now I suggest we could talk to Arkady Moshes, the director of the Russian program at the International Studies Institute in Helsinki, Finland. Arkady,
thank you very much for joining us. Could you please explain to us, how do you see that? Why has the process against Ms. Tymoshenko started? Because no one seemed to mind her signing the contract when she was doing that back in 2009.
Well, I think the main reason behind this process is internal Ukrainian politics. The Party of the Regions is very quickly losing popularity and support, and it's facing ever more unpopular reforms. And the parliamentary elections are coming in about 1 year or 15 months from now. It would be very difficult for the party of the regions to guarantee the parliamentary majority if the opposition is powerful and strong. And if they fail during those elections, I mean, this whole vertical of the presidential power in Ukraine will be in jeopardy. So the only chance, because there is no chance that Ukraine will get out of the economic troubles within this year, so the only chance for the party of the regions to stay in power and to maybe even consolidate its grip on power is to weaken the opposition. And, I mean, this is one of the things. Basically, we are talking about possible decapitation of the opposition. So about the party of the region wants the opposition not to have such a powerful, energetic, charismatic leader as Mrs. Yulia Tymoshenko is.
Which means that Mr. Yanukovych is simply afraid of her as a potential competitor at the election. Is my understanding correct?
Yes, afraid is maybe too strong a word, but definitely it would be a lot more convenient for the party of the regions to wage the campaign if the main figure of the opposition, such as Yulia Tymoshenko, is weakened. She doesn't have to be necessarily imprisoned or sentenced by that, but it's just good if she has to spend her energy on legal cases, on litigation, and so on, rather than on the political campaign.
Is it going to affect the relations between Ukraine and Russia?
I would say not very much, because the opposition cannot run on the pro-Russian platform in any way, unlike when the time when Mr. Yanukovych was in the opposition. And the Ukrainian-Russian relations are now in a very bad shape. They are stagnating. None of the questions which is currently on the agenda is being solved, or actually can be solved, because after Yanukovych so badly played the Sevastopol card last year, he doesn't have another trump card to use. And while Russia is in the driver's seat, because if Russia does not get control of the Ukrainian pipeline system, it can continue the construction of the bypass pipelines. If it doesn't get control over the Ukrainian, let's say, crown jewels, it can be comfortably further raising the gas prices for Ukraine. The Ukrainian political elite is now fully aware of the troubles in which it finds itself. But by means of bringing up the case against Tymoshenko, it would not be able to affect Russian-Ukrainian relations in any way.
And with this, we end this Red Line, brought to you by the Voice of Russia radio station. It was presented by its founders, Sergei Strokin and Mira Salganik, and me, Ekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you very much for staying with us. Goodbye and take care.
Take care and goodbye.
So long.
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 Goodbye.
So long.